Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With 58,000 troops in Afghanistan at the beginning of this year and 30,000 more ordered in for President Obama's surge, U.S. strategy in the Afghan war matters. At $75 billion a year and constant casualties all around, the price is steep for everyone. My guest today says we're being sold a lot of myths about Afghanistan, that U.S. strategy is not working and won't work. We'll hear his case and the counterview. This hour on Point, U.S. strategy in year 9 of the Afghan war. You can join the conversation. Have you put this war out of sight, out of mind? And what would you say this week to Hamid Karzai in Washington, to President Obama on the Afghan war? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington for the latest on Afghan President Hamid Karzai's visit is Karen DeYoung, senior diplomatic reporter for The Washington Post. Karen, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
Tell us about the Obama agenda for this visit and the Karzai agenda, I guess, and how each appears to be doing.
Well, I think for both of them, the largest point is to mend what's been a pretty testy relationship over the past year. The Obama administration is very concerned about corruption in Afghanistan. They want Karzai to clean it up. They're afraid that Congress won't give them the money to pursue the war if it's not cleaned up, and that, in fact, their strategy won't be effective, that a lot of money will go down the drain. Karzai wants some reassurance that the United States is there for the long term, that they're very concerned about President Obama's announcement that he wants to begin withdrawing troops the middle of 2011, and they would like a deal kind of similar to the deal the Bush administration negotiated with Iraq, which is a long-term strategic partnership that commits the United States to some level of security cooperation and a lot of economic assistance for a long time down the road.
Is there the real thought that the complaints that have been so publicly aired by the administration about the Karzai administration, from stolen elections to corruption, as you mentioned, to a lack of effectiveness as a government period, I mean, can those things really be, you know, sort of corrected and then fine, we're on our way again? Or, you know, nobody believes it can happen, but we've got to make nice with the best face on it.
I would say the answer is somewhere in the middle of those two alternatives. I don't think there's a lot of confidence that there are going to be a lot of real rapid changes within the Afghan government, but I think there has been a decision not to be quite so public about the criticism, not only because it doesn't seem to work very well, but it also, as Karzai has argued, I think pretty effectively, it undercuts his position in Afghanistan and makes it more difficult for him to be a useful partner to the United States there. So I think everybody sort of agreed to tone it down. There's also a realization, I think more of a realization in the United States, that at least within the administration, that corruption is kind of a relative term. In fact, the vast bulk of the money now in Afghanistan is United States money that's doled out through contracts, often to Afghans themselves. And to the extent that there's corruption, it's misspending and parceling out our own money because we're not very careful about the way that we dispense it, and we rely on a lot of Afghans. There are a lot of Afghans that are getting very, very rich as a result of our presence there.
Karen, it was just last summer that the memo was put together by General McChrystal saying that without more forces, that this the Afghan war would likely result in failure. Now, a bunch more forces have been produced. Here we are. It's now May of 2010. We're in the ninth year of this war. Is there a consensus in the administration about whether things are going better, about whether we're gaining or, you know, losing ground, winning or losing here?
Well, you know, I just came back from Afghanistan, and it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. The military had complained under the Bush administration that they didn't have a coherent strategy. They didn't have metrics by which they could gauge their progress. They didn't have an agreed endpoint to which various operations were contributing. So they're happy with the Obama administration because he did come up with a strategy. And it has certain things that they're supposed to do. They're out in Helmand province in the southwest, where they're taking back literally inch by inch territory from the Taliban. They're about to move into Kandahar in the south, which is the kind of Taliban homeland and the second biggest city in Afghanistan. So as they complete each of their tasks, you know, we'll take over this village, we'll move into this area, they're happy that they've achieved objectives. I think as they mark off these objectives, it's easy to say, well, therefore we are succeeding in our larger goal to rid Afghanistan of extremism and deny the opportunity for al-Qaeda to reestablish itself there. Whether the sum of those parts equals up to winning that overall objective, I don't think is at all clear yet. And there's also the problem of once you take over a village or a town, or at least drive the Taliban out, what happens next? Do you have enough trained Afghan forces to go in and allow you to leave? Do you have a capable government entity to provide services for the Afghan people and convince them that they're better off and more secure and that they have an economic future and a political future with the Taliban gone?
Some of those, most of those questions, not with clear answers so far, at least, and surely some tough conversations, but also a lot of diplomatic talk, face-saving in Washington this week. Karen DeYoung with The Washington Post, thank you very much for being with us, Karen.
You're welcome.
Here's Commander of U.S. Forces in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, at a White House briefing off the Karzai visit on Monday. He was talking about optimism, about progress in Afghanistan, but he did speak to remaining challenges.
Our efforts in Afghanistan are ultimately about changing the perceptions of people. Afghans long impacted by conflict and struggle believe more of what they see than what they hear. Only when they experience security from coercion and only when they benefit from better governance will they begin to believe in the possibilities of the future. This is a process that takes time. It will demand courage and resilience. We will encounter increased violence as our combined security forces expand into Taliban-controlled areas.
General McChrystal on the situation in Afghanistan as Hamid Karzai was coming into Washington. Joining us now from Pacific Grove, California is Thomas Johnson. He's director of the Program for Culture and Conflict Studies at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. For decades, he's been traveling back and forth to Afghanistan, has written extensively about the country. He briefs deploying U.S. troops on Afghanistan and the war effort. Thomas Johnson, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
You are very, very tough on the American effort in Afghanistan. You call the current strategy a time-honored recipe for defeat. You say it cannot work and that we're tangled up in myths. Myths like what?
Well, let me start out by saying I think that we have to ask one pragmatic question relative to Afghanistan. And that question is if the war is winnable. I believe that if it's not winnable, then any further sacrifice of American blood and treasure for principles borders on immorality, in my opinion. But I think that many of our strategies, unfortunately, are failing in large part, as you suggested, because they're either based implicitly or explicitly on myths.
You've got a dozen of those here. Your conclusion is there is no chance of success with the current strategy. So what are these punky myths that it's standing on?
Well, let's start out with the upcoming operations in Kandahar. I think there's a myth that whoever controls Kandahar controls the country and the campaign for Kandahar will be decisive. While Kandahar is important, it's the sort of the spiritual center of the Taliban. If you take a look at history, the British controlled Kandahar twice. The Soviets controlled Kandahar from the day that they invaded the country until when they left. We have to understand that the people in Jalalabad, the people in Mazar, the people in Kunduz, people in other cities basically are interested in their own local concerns. Kandahar is extremely important for the Kandaharis. There's not really a broad sense of nationalism in Afghanistan. So I believe that one of our most pervasive myths that we're following right now is that we're going to try to take Kandahar and that we'll be decisive. And whoever controls Kandahar controls the country. And I just think that that's not true.
You've looked at this, tried to interpret what's really going on here. President Obama is talking about drawing down starting in July 2011. That's not so far now. And you've written that the one militarily defensible purpose for taking Kandahar might be to concentrate U.S. forces in urban areas for withdrawal.
Well, I think that's a possibility. I think that turning Kandahar into a garrison city is not going to be our recipe for success. So I think in many respects, I have great respect for General McChrystal. I think that he understands the situation very well. But I don't understand this notion of his attempts to control 10 urban areas. We're fighting a rural insurgency in Afghanistan, and we have to control the rural areas. I think ultimately the Soviets controlled the provincial capitals as well as the capital of the country, Kabul, and most of the other urban areas, and were unsuccessful. I think that the way that we prosecute a war against a rural insurgency is to fight in the rural areas and to separate the people from the insurgents. And I think that we're going to start to focus way too much on the urban areas. So as I hypothesized, could possibly have other types of ulterior motives, but those are purely hypothetical.
But if General McChrystal has such a good grip on things, how can things be going, at least in your view, so badly? You call that his current strategy time-honored recipe for defeat.
Well, I think that if you take a look at our own manuals and doctrine on counterinsurgency, it suggests a certain number of security providers for a certain amount of the population. If we actually followed our manual and our doctrine to the T, it would require 640,000 troops in Afghanistan. We just don't have the troops in the areas to be able to perform the way I think General McChrystal would like us to do. So I think that we're really behind an eight ball.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour as Afghan President Hamid Karzai visits Washington in the White House today about a big, tough new critique of U.S. strategy in Afghanistan that says it has no chance of success. Thomas Johnson joins us from California, the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He's been watching Afghanistan for a long, long time, and he's written a very tough critique of strategy there. Says it's just not working, that it won't succeed. We'll hear from our old friend Stephen Biddle, who's got a nuanced eye on what's going on in Afghanistan these days. Thomas Johnson, what about President Karzai in Washington this week? He's having dinner with the vice president tonight. It wasn't so long ago that Vice President Biden sort of strutted out of a dinner with Karzai in Kabul because of the denials of corruption there. How do you see Hamid Karzai as he sits down with the top American leadership this week?
Well, I think that there is a certain amount of fence mending that's going to take place to try to smooth out tensions in the relationship and the partnership between the United States and Afghanistan. I think that Hamid Karzai clearly recognizes that the United States will be leaving, and I think that he's seeking clarification relative to President Obama's plans concerning withdrawal and by mid-2011, as well as looking for an outline of what our long-term economic and security relationship with the country will be. And I think that Obama, as your previous guest suggested, is surely going to focus on questions of corruption and legitimacy and those types of issues. But this all comes in the context of Ambassador Eikenberry's, you know, leaked cable last year that basically denounced Karzai as an
adequate strategic
security partner.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, I think that our hardline approach hasn't really worked, and I think that there's real questions on how we deal with Karzai. Ultimately, history would suggest that to succeed in a counterinsurgency such as we're fighting in Afghanistan, one has to have a legitimate local partner. And I just don't believe that Hamid Karzai is viewed as legitimate by the vast majority of the Afghan population. And this is very damning to our strategies and operations as well as tactics in the country.
Even beyond legitimacy, you're very tough on the Afghan president. You say he's descended into a bizarre world of conspiracy theories, not unlike Hitler in the bunker. In 1945, you quote U.S. Ambassador Eikenberry calling him erratic, former deputy U.N. envoy there, Peter Galbraith, calling him mentally unstable. That's beyond issues of legitimacy.
Well, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not going to judge his mental capacity, but he said some things that are very, very bizarre and strange to me. And you know, his father was killed by the Taliban in the late 1990s, and for him to be able to make a statement, you know, even in jest, that he might join the Taliban if certain things don't go his way, doesn't jive at all with the cultural mores of the Pashtun people. I mean, if your father is killed, you have an obligation, in fact, a need to be able to revenge that. So statements such as, I might possibly join the Taliban, border on such erratic type of behavior that it's hard for me to judge his stability.
You say it's a myth that an Afghan army is being put together effectively, a myth that Afghan police force is being put together, a myth that the Obama strategy has a real chance of success. But what's your answer here, Thomas Johnson? I mean, President Obama said in the campaign, we have to win here or we face a mortal threat back in old al-Qaeda country.
Well, I've called for years. I think that we've had a solution for Afghanistan. It's based, at least theoretically, around the Provincial Reconstruction Team concept, based not only providing security but also development and meeting the needs of the people. But I think that we tried to operate at the wrong levels. The Americans presently have 13 Provincial Reconstruction Teams for maybe 13 or 14 million Pashtuns. So they turn out to be strategically inadequate at basically a grain of sand on the beach. What we needed to do, I think, is to be able to move down and operate where the Taliban are operating 24/7, 365, and that's at the district and local village areas. And we should have moved our provincial reconstruction teams down to the district. In fact, make them district reconstruction teams. I think that General McChrystal is experimenting with some district stability teams. But the problem is that we try to operate and prosecute this war from large garrisons or forward operating bases. A couple of years ago, I was a cultural advisor at a very large forward operating base, or FOB, in Coast, and less than 5% of the people ever left the wire, meaning they never mm-hmm. went out and actually operated with the people. So, you know, we talk about this clear, hold, and build strategy. But I think for the last 8 years, most of our strategy has been clear return to forward operating base, clear return to forward operating base.
So you're saying if we got in deeper and with more troops, we'd have a better chance?
Well, I don't think that we necessarily have to have more troops. I think that it's a question, not a quantitative one, but a qualitative one, how the troops are used. I think that if we had a district reconstruction team in each one of the 200 districts in the east and the south of the country, and I'm talking about maybe 100 NATO security providers complemented with ANA as well as the Afghan National Police, as well as development specialists from hydrologists to agricultural specialists, we might be able to meet the needs of the people. I mean, I think we've tried to do too much top-down, but all Afghan identity bubbles up from the village level. So I think that we've been prosecuting the war at the wrong level and not really finding out what the people want.
Instead, we're heading into an urban strategy, you say, and 5% outside the wire. Hold that thought, if you would. I want to go to Stephen Biddle in just a moment here, but Thomas Johnson, we've got so many callers. Marshall in Hickory, North Carolina. Marshall, you are on the air.
Thank you. Appreciate you taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have an opinion, and I have a question. While we were in Iraq and still there, but when we were fighting the most, and they decided to take the surge, you know, and have it.
Right, right.
You know, that worked real well. It did. The surge worked. Now, if we was to apply that same strategy to Afghanistan, you know, put more troops in there, take care of the trouble spots, and then get the people, you know, to start coming along with us just like they did in Iraq, you know, that would have a big impact. More troops on the ground in Afghanistan will have a great impact. For one thing, the insurgency that's coming from Pakistan
mm-hmm.
is not going to stop, you know. They're not going to stop.
Marshall, let us look at it, because we've got, you say let's have a surge, and in fact we have one right now. Thomas Johnson, what about it? A lot of people look at Iraq and say, well, you know, there was a lot of resistance on the surge front, but maybe it worked out all right. Why not here?
Well, I think that it's a myth to think that the strategies and policies that we pursued in Iraq are necessarily going to work in Afghanistan. It's a very, very different context. Let's remember that Iraq was basically an urban insurgency. Now, there obviously was fighting in the rural hinterlands, but in Afghanistan, 80% of the people live in rural areas. You have a national literacy rate of maybe 10% versus Iraq, where you had a developed infrastructure and literacy well over 90%. So it's an extremely different context. in Afghanistan. The tribal dynamics are much more complicated. So I think the type of strategies that we pursued in Iraq don't have a probability of a high success rate in Afghanistan for a wide variety of structural and policy considerations.
Let's go to Billy in Brookline, New Hampshire. Billy, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to say that I agreed with your caller. I'm a veteran. I've done Afghanistan and Iraq and probably going to go back to Afghanistan before it's over.
Thank you.
And in short, we try to focus in the wrong areas. We try to root out the last bits with our military, but it's really the, like I said, at the village level and the management of reconstruction. I've been where we've given just a little bit to reconstruction and the rest is trying to go in to defend that. And we never follow through the money. And the last comment I have is that our government wants it more than, say, Pakistan and Afghanistan want it, as far as a victory over, say, Taliban and insurgent groups.
So, Billy, I want to be sure I understand. Are you saying you agree with Thomas Johnson? Get down at the district and village level and develop there, or you're in trouble or not?
Oh, yes. I think I agree with him that we do, because our military is primarily set up to strike hard and get rid of an enemy. But really, the development is how you keep that from bubbling up again.
That would put you right on the same page as Tom Johnson. Thanks for your call, Billy. Thomas Johnson in Pacific Grove, California, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Stephen Biddle, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, former Chair of Military Studies at the U.S. Army War College. He was a member of General McChrystal's initial assessment team that produced last summer's McChrystal Report, calling for more forces. He's author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle. Stephen Biddle, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got a big, complicated situation here in Afghanistan. Thomas Johnson looks at it, and his bottom line is that we have no chance of success with the current strategy. Now, I know you're not a black-and-white guy, but we're in year 9, and people are wondering, how do you see what's going on?
I think what we have in Afghanistan is a reasonable prospect that we can succeed in getting something tolerable at the end. We're not going to produce Switzerland and the Hindu Kush. We're not going to get what the Secretary of Defense dismissed as Valhalla in South Asia. Mm-hmm. I think we have a reasonable chance, no guarantee, but a reasonable chance that we can get at the end of this something that respects our two core national security interests in this conflict, that Afghan territory not be used as a base for terrorists to strike the West, and that Afghan territory not be used as a base for insurgents to destabilize its neighbors, and especially Pakistan. Those are pretty limited objectives, and we have the advantage of an enemy that is in many ways very flawed. The Taliban are not 10 feet tall. They're mm-hmm. not the Waffen-SS. And moreover, they're not particularly popular in Afghanistan. Afghans had the experience of living under Taliban rule. They know more or less what's involved. At the national level, there's been very, very little indication of a stomach for a return to that. The Taliban have pockets in which they're more popular than they are in others. The South has been their historical strong point. That's one of the reasons why the emphasis in the campaign at the moment is in the South.
Mm-hmm.
But given that our objectives are pretty limited, and given that our opponent is pretty flawed, I think what that gives us is a decent chance that if we're willing to pay the price involved, which is high, that we can come out of this with our core interests intact.
Thomas Johnson, how about it? Never mind Valhalla in the Hindu Kush, but with the limited objectives, as Stephen Biddle describes them, though they don't sound that easy, but nevertheless, limited objectives, you know, that Afghanistan not be a basis for forces that would strike the U.S., that it not be undermining Pakistan next door. Do you see us on track, Tom, for those limited objectives?
Well, unfortunately, I don't believe we are. I think one of the real problems in Afghanistan is that even 9 years into the conflict, I'm not really sure what our explicit desired end state is. I mean, President Obama talks about disrupting, dismantling, and defeating al-Qaeda, but Admiral Mullins himself has suggested there's less than 100 al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. I'm not worried about the Pakistani Taliban, or I'm sorry, the Afghan Taliban attacking me in SFO. I think they're very different than
SFO, the airport there in San
The airport in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think they're very different than the Pakistani Taliban, who has much more. Apparently, it now has much more of a global jihadist outlook. But I think that our problem has been is that we really haven't articulated our goal. If our strategy really is to dismantle, disrupt, and defeat Al Qaeda, then I think that a focus on Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan might be more important than Afghanistan. And this is hard for me to say. I mean, I personally would like to see nation building in Afghanistan from the bottom up. We surely can't do that in this economy. I mean, I have a great affinity for the country, and I surely don't want to see us leave and have a resulting civil war, which I think is eventually going to happen. But I think one of the real problems is that I'm not really convinced what our desired end state is. I think Steve Biddle rightfully suggests some things that might be tolerable, but I think even there it's going to be very difficult to accomplish. I mean, we don't have an Afghan national security force that's going to be able to pick up after we leave. I think the Afghan National Army, 9 years in, according to all news reports I've seen, did not perform very well at all in Marja. In fact, some of the Marines that I've spoke to were not impressed. I mean, the New York Times talks about embedded U.S. soldiers with the Afghan National Army being very upset and painting a stark picture, you know, terrible soldiering, you know, drug abuse, lack of aggressive behavior, bad command and control. I just don't think that even for a more limited goals that we have the type of infrastructure and other dynamics that will be necessary for it to be pulled off.
Steve Biddle, there's a little bit of the pea moving under the shells there. Disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda is one thing. You describe maybe more limited objectives or different objectives in Afghanistan proper. I mean, is there a formal sort of definition of objectives? The limited ones you describe, Stephen, are those understood by everybody, carved on the Oval Office wall?
I don't know if they're carved in the Oval Office wall, but they've been very explicitly stated by the president on multiple occasions. The two minimum requirements I gave are absolutely mm-hmm. orthodox U.S. government policy. Now, for my own part, I don't think they're equally important. I think of the two interests the administration has repeatedly articulated, Afghanistan itself not become a base for an al-Qaeda to attack the U.S. and Afghanistan not become a base for destabilizing Pakistan, the second is the more important of the two. The president tends to talk more about the first, but there are lots of places, as Tom Johnson mentioned, that could also be basis for al-Qaeda to attack the United States, whether it's Yemen or whether it's Somalia or whether it's Djibouti or whether it's any of a dozen other possibilities. Afghanistan isn't literally unique in that sense. It is literally unique as a direct proximate neighbor of Pakistan, a nuclear weapon state with an ongoing insurgency within its borders and the global headquarters of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. If that insurgency in Pakistan goes badly and that government falls, that's one of the very few ways I can think of that strike me as being remotely plausible that al-Qaeda could actually get its hands on a usable nuclear weapon. Instability in Afghanistan, if the counterinsurgency project there fails mm-hmm. and that government collapses into something either looking like anarchy and civil warfare or some sort of Taliban restoration, that is a substantial source of increased instability in Pakistan, a country that where we have extraordinary national interests at stake and where we have very little ability to directly make the situation better through policy initiatives in Pakistan itself because of our unpopularity with the Pakistani population. So I think these two core objectives mm-hmm. have been articulated repeatedly. I think they're both important, but I think the second one is the more consequential of the two.
Tom Johnson, we just got half a minute before the break, but in brief, Stephen Biddle paints the picture that says we can't pull away, even if it's not working by your lights. We've got to be there.
Well, yeah, I agree that Afghanistan does have important implications for our national security. I'm not willing to judge to the degree right now. And I think that he's absolutely correct that Pakistan is the key, especially with their strategic power and other type of dynamics. But, I mean, I think that one of the myths of Afghanistan is that Pakistan actually wants to see us succeed. I think there's important elements in Pakistan that are interested in putting the Taliban back to power. I'm not saying it's official government strategy, but I think there's important elements within the society because they hate the hint of any independence in Kabul and can't abide by having the citizen of India, you know, being there and having an important role. So I think
Thomas Johnson,
real question.
Stand by if you would. We'll come right back to that. And Stephen Biddle in Washington, we're talking about U.S. strategy in Afghanistan and its prospects. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. talking this hour as Hamid Karzai visits Washington about a big tough critique of U.S. strategy in Afghanistan that says it has no chance of success. We're hearing a different view in this hour as well. It says we have to win, at least with limited objectives, and that we may still be on a track to achieve those limited objectives. And Afghan vets were particularly interested in your perspective here. Here's a web comment from Khalil. Says, I agree with your guest that we're wasting time and money and lives for nation building when we're so economically weak. Our priority should be local problems here at home, says Khalil. Darian says, we need to push agriculture in Afghanistan away from poppy production. If we spent half as much money on agriculture as we did on the war, he says, we might have a chance there. Let's get a call from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just wanted to throw in my comments that was based on my research and my experience in Operation Enduring Freedom 8 and 9, where I had a lot of opportunity to work not only with our own soldiers, but with the Afghan National Army, as well as with a lot of the local religious leaders. And in terms of...
You were there in Afghanistan? In what service were you there, Jonathan?
In the Army.
Army, okay.
Yeah. It appears that our past strategy has sought to establish and support the top-level leaders, and we've focused really exclusively on the political offices and on the military strength, and that's really understandable coming from a Western perspective. It's what our culture here looks for in a successful nation state, you know, functioning democracy and the ability to defend oneself. However, the nation of Afghanistan, it doesn't function according to this kind of Western blueprint. It's the middle range leaders, those, and that being the religious leaders there, the mullahs and the ulema, the religious scholars that are there, that are really in the best position to influence those above, being the government, and those below, being the citizens. And in one of my many engagements with the religious leaders there, one of the mullahs said to me, he said, Karzai makes his plans, but there are mullahs whispering in his ears. And he later on added that the Afghans love the mullahs. Any person who goes against a mullah, all Afghanistan is against that person.
So could the machinery of American power be brought to bear to win them over to Kabul or to the objectives that Stephen Biddle's described here, Jonathan?
Well, it really seems like there needs to be, and I think that we're starting to see more of a including those religious leaders that are pro-government and anti-Taliban over there, trying to bring them in and seeing that, yes, they are an effective tool to achieve the stability in the region. You know, as you look at the history of Afghanistan,
yeah,
throughout its many conflicts, it's been the religious leaders there, the mullahs, that have maintained the stability. When the government has been lacking, it's been the mullahs who have stood in and taken the place. When the citizens have been needing stuff, it's the mullahs who have been there throughout history. And so as a result, they're the ones who are able to kind of gather the masses. They have the most honored place. They have the audience there. And they're kind of unquestioned.
They've got the sway. You know. Let us look at that. It's a great point, Jonathan. I appreciate your call. Thomas Johnson, what about it? Win the mullahs and you may win the effort. Do we have the stuff to do that?
Well, I don't know. I think that a counterinsurgency can basically be defined as an information war supported by military actions and kinetics. And one of the reasons that the Taliban have been relatively successful is that they understand what resonates with the Afghan people, and their information campaign is much stronger than ours. I think that that the gentleman made some very excellent points. I think the mullahs are very important. But traditionally, if you go back before the invasion of the Soviets in 1979, the mullahs were basically apolitical. They served as spiritual consultants to the village elders. All that changed when we, as well as the Pakistani ISI, wanted to be able to promote more jihadists to go in and fight the Soviet Union. So we helped to create the mullahs as a political player. I think that he had a couple of excellent points. I think that we often suggest that this is a basic, almost we sometimes describe this war almost as if it was a secular insurgency. I think that what's going on in Afghanistan right now is an insurgency wrapped in the narrative of jihad. And it's very difficult for us to be able to play on that information field because we're just not going to get into some of the religious tropes. So I think he made a couple of very good points. I think that if we could have the mullahs go back to their traditional role of serving the spiritual advisors to the village elders, much of our problems in Afghanistan would be solved. But I just don't see how we can put the genie back into the bottle. I think it's going to be very, very difficult to do it.
Stephen Biddle, what about it? The U.S. military with its tools and its, you know, the cut of its jib, can it win over the spiritual leaders of Afghan locales, and would that work?
Well, I think the caller has this point right on both scores. One is you have to decentralize your governance effort if you're going to succeed, and the second is that is exactly the thrust of current U.S. government policy. We began this war with what I think was an unrealistic ambition for a highly centralized, bureaucratized state run from Kabul. That has not worked. And I think what's going on now is a very deliberate attempt to decentralize governance function out of Kabul down to the provinces, the districts, and the villages. And that means working through not just mullahs, but also tribal leaders, local shuras and jirgas, that the traditional community governance structures where legitimacy has resided in Afghanistan for centuries. I think we cut very much against the trend of the long history of Afghanistan with the government we tried to set up in 2001. I think we have now made a decision that we're going to seek in some ways less ambitious objectives, but in other ways objectives that are a better fit with the underlying society we're operating in.
Tom Johnson, how about it? We've done it. We've got it. We're on the right track. We are looking at decentralized efforts.
Well, I think theoretically we are. I want to see evidence of it. I think that we had this we were talking about government in a box.
On the way into Marja, this latest offensive, they said they'd go in with the military and then bring in the sort of ready-to-go turnkey government to set up locally.
Yeah, I think that we try to create expectations of rapidity and efficiency in a government that we could easily set up, but I think it's much more difficult than that. I wish I was wrong, but even the reports coming back from Marja suggest now that once the lights are out, the Taliban are very, very influential in this area. So, yeah, I just don't know if we have the nuanced approach to be able to build up local governance. I hope that I'm wrong, but I just don't see it.
Let's go to Lisa in Missouri Valley, Iowa. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, given whether our goals in Afghanistan are either broad or limited, it would appear that most of the, it all boils down to you have to have a stable Afghanistan. And given the fact that we've had 9 years of military option and that most experts agree that it's a tribal faction.
Right.
And even our own military agree that the best results we have are when we do infrastructure and nation building. Why is there not more emphasis within our U.S. policy on nation building? What is the resistance, or where is the resistance? It would seem that it would even be cheaper for us to do that than to try and pour more troops in.
Let me take it to our panel. Thank you very much, Lisa. Stephen Biddle, what do you say?
Well, nation building is a big term. Let me break it down into a couple of its components so we can add some specificity to this. Let's take economic development, for example. We would clearly like to be able to engage in economic reconstruction projects in Afghanistan that would boost the GDP and employ Afghans and create disincentives for Taliban alignment. The problem is the Taliban blow them up. In the current situation in which we have a reasonably widespread active insurgency, we cannot simply engage in benign, apolitical, unsupported economic development activity in that dimension of nation building. It requires a security presence in order to enable it to occur because the Taliban understand that economic activity is not apolitical. It will build connections between the population and the government if it's allowed to proceed, and thus they prevent it from proceeding. So the security element and the war making that's going on in Afghanistan is in large part intended to enable that kind of economic development activity. In terms of the governance part of nation building, we started out with an extraordinarily ambitious nation building project. We were going to radically transform all of Afghan society.
Right.
We've backed away quite a bit from that level of ambition. We haven't backed away completely from the undertaking of nation building. We've just approached it in a more decentralized way that's designed to be a closer fit to the underlying society of the nation that we're trying to build. But as your caller suggests, I think policy at the moment very clearly believes that some degree of, let's say, governance improvement is critically important to succeeding or failing in this war, that the entire campaign is designed around enabling that, but it has to begin with security. If you don't have security on the ground, none of the rest of it can happen. A final point on this score is how you get security on the ground. And I think it's a mistake to view the current campaign as somehow urban-focused or just a battle for the city of Kandahar. The entire thrust of U.S. counterinsurgency doctrine for at least the last 3 or 4 years, beyond just Afghanistan itself, has been precisely about protecting the population where the population lives. Mm. If the population is rural, you're eventually going to have to protect the rural population. Petraeus had this famous quote where he said, "You cannot succeed in counterinsurgency by commuting to work,"
right,
which he meant that you could not be limited to big bases out in the desert somewhere.
But Tom Johnson says that's what's happening, that only 5% of the people he saw were outside the wire, as he put it.
His observation was from 2 years ago, as he put mm-hmm. it, and I think that mm-hmm. was a pretty accurate characterization mm-hmm. 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The entire thrust of current strategy is to overturn that. Now, this has to proceed by stages and by triage, though. We don't have the resources to blanket Afghanistan all at once with the kind of troop density required to do this. You have to start in a few places and build out from there as the indigenous security forces get larger and get more capable. If we were to lose Afghanistan's cities, we would lose the war immediately. So although it's not sufficient to protect places like Kandahar and places, for that matter, like the Helmand River Valley, where we've already put a lot of effort in, is not exactly a huge Western metropolis by most of our standards. It's a pretty rural area itself. We can't stop there, and we don't plan to stop there, nor does the current plan anticipate stopping there. That's a first step. It's not by any means the extent of the design of the current campaign.
Mm-hmm. And so in the ninth year, Thomas Johnson, I mean, here we are. You've got this blanket statement that you write, there's no chance of success with the current strategy. Stephen Biddle says, well, dig in here, and we've got the right strategy, and we're plugging away at it. And what's more, we have to. What do you say, Tom?
Well, I truthfully hope that Stephen Biddle is correct, but if you take a look even at the most recent Pentagon report to Congress on Afghanistan, there was a very interesting figure in there where it presents a map of Afghanistan and highlights the 21 key districts that General McChrystal and his staff has identified as absolutely critical. And relative to those 21 key districts, not one by the Pentagon's own ratings is supporting the government, and only 29 or 24% are sympathetic to the government. So I just think that we're spread too thin. How are we going to turn these 121 key districts into places that have suitable government? And, you know, what does government in the box mean? I really hope that Stephen Biddle is correct, but I just don't see it happening over the short term, especially recognizing that inside the Beltway, I believe people desperately want to get out of Afghanistan. So, you know, this is a generational problem, and I think that we've lost. I think that we've lost patience with the campaign and strategy in many respects, and I think the Afghans have also lost patience with us. So, you know, I hate to be pessimistic. I wish I could be optimistic, but I just don't see any signs that give me that warm and fuzzy feeling.
Suzanne in Wallingford, Vermont. One time for one more call here, Suzanne, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Suzanne. My son is in the Marines. He's currently stationed in Marja.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been there since February when they first went in there. And one of the things I'm really concerned about is the strategy to turn over the operations to the Afghan army. And from everything that I've heard from my son, it doesn't sound like that's a strategy that's going to work anytime soon. They've had a lot of problems. Some of it's been covered in the media with the Afghans with drugs, and with, you know, stealing from the Marines and from the locals.
Is he optimistic about that strategy or frustrated? Suzanne, what?
He's frustrated because, if that's part of the strategy, they're supposed to be working towards turning it over to the Afghan army at some point.
Right.
And it's not working. They're very disappointed in the Afghans.
There's a frontline report from a mother of a Marine, and Suzanne, we thank you and your son. Tom Johnson, our time grows short here. Maybe the best way, we acknowledge that, Suzanne, we've heard some about that, and it's interesting to hear it confirmed. Tom, you say that of all the myths that you point out, you say the Uber myth, a kind of Tolkien-esque one myth to bind them all myth, you say, is this: Afghanistan is the just or necessary or right or central to the war on terror war. Is it not?
Well, again, I'll go back to my notion that if the goal is to dismantle, disrupt, and defeat Al-Qaeda, Afghanistan is not the place to do that. That's not to suggest that Afghanistan is not important. I think it is, as Stephen Biddle pointed out, relative to the Pakistan and other types of regional dynamics. But, you know, if our major goal is focused on Al-Qaeda, I just don't think Afghanistan's the place.
And what about, will we ultimately talk with, negotiate with, reconcile with the Taliban? Is that the path out if the urgency to leave is as you describe it?
Well, I think that President Karzai thinks it is, and I think there's elements within our regime that also think it is. But I think that it's a non-starter. I think that the Mullah Omar, as well as his lieutenants, have been very clear over the last 3 or 4 years that they're only willing to negotiate once the internationals leave. I mean, you know, there's a great body of evidence that suggests that insurgencies end through reconciliation and negotiation, but most of these studies have focused on secular insurgencies. As I suggested earlier, this is an insurgency wrapped in the jihad, or maybe even a more damning definition is that it's a jihad, and jihadists are not going to negotiate. So I think that the people that really matter will not negotiate. We can try at the local levels. Now, relative to reconciliation, I mean, we've already pulled some people off at the local levels, and many of these people have then had marks placed on their head, and there's been a number of examples where they've been killed. So I hope, again, that I'm wrong, but I don't have a lot of faith in reconciliation and negotiations. Why would the Taliban want to negotiate? They believe that they're winning. I don't think the conditions are set right. And even reconciliation, I think that people are going to think twice before committing acts that might see them down the road hanging from a lamppost.
Well, this is great background for all of us to have as we watch the Karzai meetings in Washington this week. And I'm grateful to each of you for helping us get these insights. Thomas Johnson at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, joining us today from Pacific Grove, California. Tom Johnson, thanks very much for being with us.
My distinct pleasure. Thank you very much, Tom.
And Stephen Biddle, a senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Steve, it's always great to have you here. Thank you very much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.